which is the art of listening to problems. It was very difficult to find the name for this section. It's more than listening, but it's not really counseling. A lot has to do with an attitude in dealing with students, but it really doesn't only deal with students. I find that the techniques that we'll learn, especially the last 2 days, are extremely important in the dealings between devotees, between teachers and students, between husbands and wives and husbands, between temple presidents. Are you sitting in on the class? Huh? Oh, I wasn't even looking at you. Hare Krishna. Hare Krishna. Yeah, okay. How are you? Yeah. Yes. How are you? Good. Did you bring any Radha Nandini Swarma Prasadam? Get out. So, it's very, 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 very helpful. It stops way short. We plan on stopping way short of counseling. But so many of the problems that occur can be simply solved by this one change of attitude that we'll get to probably tomorrow and possibly this afternoon, and also by listening. So we won't get to counseling, but these techniques are so valuable in any case. Now, the first thing that we're going to lead to is how a teacher views his students' behavior. Now, we're going to be speaking in terms of teachers and students, but what we're going to be speaking of doesn't only concern teachers and students. It concerns those who are responsible for the behavior of others, and then later on it will broaden out even until we're speaking in addition about all types of interactions between people. First, so keep that in mind when we begin speaking of when we're speaking of teachers and students. We're just as easily speaking about gurus and disciples, and just as easily speaking about temple presidents and the devotees in the temple and husbands and wives, although there'll obviously be some differences in the types of problems. Now, raise your hand if you've read this material that goes from 119 to 128. Raise your hand if you have read it. Good. That's almost everyone. Now, this is going, explains how a teacher views the behavior of his students. Now, before we even can discuss this specific attitude or point, we have to understand something that's not contemporary. The concept of surrender is, practically speaking, foreign to the vocabulary of people who grow up in modern times. And the thought of surrendering to someone else is practically thought of as abominable. It's a horrible thing to have to do, what to speak of becoming a servant. But actually speaking, not only in Vedic times, but actually speaking, for transcendental knowledge to be transmitted, there must be surrender. Krishna, when he begins speaking the Bhagavad Gita, he practically doesn't begin speaking until Arjuna says, Shishyasteham Sarimam Tam Prapanam. He doesn't say anything except, "Behold, all the Kurus assembled in front of you." He doesn't begin giving instructions until Arjuna surrenders. There are basically two reasons for this. One is practical in spiritual life, and one is mystical. Which would you rather hear first? Okay, there's a practical man over there. Practically speaking, when we're talking about spiritual life, we can think of the material world. We sometimes call it a great ocean, or sometimes it's like we can think of it as a deep cavern. And this is the material world, the material life over here. And over here on the other side is spiritual life, blissful spiritual life. And here, maybe over here, there is someone standing. Now, we even use the example sometimes that, or if we look at it as a well, material life is a deep well, and here we are at the bottom of the well, and we don't know how to get out. So we use the example of the spiritual master throwing a rope down, and we hold on, or he throws the rope across. And we have to grab on tightly. Now, if we're not grabbed on tightly when he's pulling us up, it's not going to be easy. One has to be strongly holding on, or else falling down. Or in this case, it's even more graphic. If he's pulling us across to the other side and we're not holding on, in the middle, if we let go, crash, and there's pointed rocks and crocodiles and wild tigers at the bottom to eat up our broken bones. Surrender is essential. If we're not holding on tightly, if we're on the mental platform as we're getting pulled across, in the middle, we look down and say, "Oh, this is very dangerous. Look at the dangerous position. What's going to happen if this happens? And what happens if he's not going to pull me across? What happens if there is no across on the other side?" And if we're not tightly holding on and actually surrendered, we could become frightened. What am I going to do? But we're supposed to be holding on to the rope. What am I going to do? So actually speaking, from the practical point of view, we have to tightly hold on to the feet of our spiritual master, or onto the rope, depending upon what metaphor we are using. And we have to keep holding on with full faith, knowing that we know our own limitations. We have to become aware. That's why humility is important. We have to become aware of our limitations. And there is no way that we can get out or get across by our own power. So we find someone who we can truly trust, and we say, "Please, I am such a fallen soul. I have no way of getting out. I'm tired of getting kicked by Maya. I cannot stand anymore the kickings of Maya. I want to become a devotee, but I can't do it on my own. I need your help. I need you. Please be merciful and accept me as your servant." This is the mood by which a disciple approaches a spiritual master. It takes that humility. It takes acknowledging one's actual position, and it takes acknowledging the need of the strong puller of the rope to get us to the other side. Now, even for education, even mundane education in Vedic times, you cannot do it without surrendering to the Guru. There would be no None of this arguing between teachers and students, that is, or fighting between teachers and students. There would be no discipline problems. There was no silly mass education where everyone had to get educated, and therefore you have crazy students driving crazy teachers crazier. Only people who are serious about knowledge, about becoming educated, would approach a spiritual master and say, and even with their parents or individually, please teach me. I want to learn from you. Not everyone who comes has to be accepted. Please, I beg you to accept me as your student. What you have gained through your hard work, O Guru Maharaj, through your whole life, you are going to impart to me. Thank you. So without this surrender, actually, there is no practical way to get spiritual knowledge. It's too dangerous. Mystically, Krishna will not award us realization unless we please his devotees. Because knowledge is descending. It awakens within the heart by Krishna's mercy. So if Krishna isn't pleased with us, no matter what we do, we will not become advanced. We can work so hard, but if we don't please Krishna, we will not become advanced. And how do we please Krishna? Yasya prasada bhagavat prasada. Yasya aprasada nagati kito. By pleasing Krishna's devotee, then Krishna is pleased. It's so easy for us to say, yes, I want to serve God. Or much easier, because he is by definition so great, and we, as we know, are fallible and limited. So it's easy to want to serve God. But when he says that I will accept your service by serving a human being, that's how I'll accept your service, that becomes too much. It's much easier to serve God, but Krishna will not accept service directly. We have to serve through his representative, through his devotee. And then we have to actually become humble. Yes, I'll serve God, but to serve a man? Very difficult. And practically speaking, if you don't go into that relationship accepting that he is perfect and that everything he is doing is perfect, there'll be so many faults that you'll see. You'll see so many faults. So one has to be convinced before one surrenders that I'm surrendering to Krishna's representative, and what I give to him, Krishna's going to appreciate. And what I give to him, Krishna's going to accept. And therefore, because he is Krishna's representative, he is perfect. Not because his eyesight is perfect, or he's a perfect dresser, or he knows this amount of verses, or he knows this, or he knows that. It is not like that. It is a matter of simply Krishna choosing him because of his qualification as his representative. And then we surrender. And then when Krishna sees that we're understanding how his reciprocation with us by sending us someone to surrender to his representative, then he awards us Bhagavat Prasad. He awards his own mercy. By the pleasure of Guru, then the Lord's mercy comes. So this is the basic principle, prerequisite for knowledge. And even the Bhagavad Gita states in the 18th chapter, after explaining the entire Bhagavad Gita, Krishna says, do not explain this to the faithless, to those who are already not devotees. Who are not devotees already, don't explain this to them. This is Krishna's instruction. So therefore, there were no discipline problems in Vedic times. If you don't accept the teacher as the authority, then find someone else to learn from who you can accept. There were no discipline problems. But but these times are practically speaking finished. We're all trained in skepticism. We're all trained from the very beginning not to serve anyone, that it's demeaning to become a servant. No, and to surrender to someone means you're giving up your individuality. So because of this training, it is so difficult to surrender to one's teacher, to the wife, to the husband, the students to the teacher, the citizens to the government. And of course, there have been so many improper authorities that... because that's one of the worst things that can happen, practically speaking, is when an authority is bad. Because that gives everyone just the excuse that they're looking for. Well, how can I surrender to authority? Look what happened when I surrendered this time. Because everyone, the conditioned souls in the material world, they don't want to surrender. We don't want to surrender because we want to be independent. That's why we're here in the material world. We want to be independent enjoyers and controllers. So a bad authority gives everyone just the excuse that they want to not surrender. So therefore, although the facility of surrendering to a bona fide spiritual master or a bona fide teacher or a bona fide temple president or a bona fide husband or a bona fide anything, government, it's the greatest facility to making our life peaceful and secure. Just practically speaking, we are sure of what we are doing, and mystically speaking, from the mystical, esoteric point of view, Krishna is pleased and he accepts service done in that mood. But as I said, this is very difficult in Kali Yuga. It is very difficult. The children are rebellious. Everyone is rebellious. So therefore, Krishna himself, he made surrender a prerequisite before teaching. Shishyashtiham sarimam tam pramanam sarvadamam prityaja mamekam sharanam vraja. Krishna made it a prerequisite, but Chaitanya Mahaprabhu, he did not make it a prerequisite before bestowing the benediction of knowledge and advancement on the devotees. He did not force everyone to surrender and demand that as a prerequisite. Rather, from my experience and from understanding something of Mahaprabhu's teachings and watching Prabhupada, surrender comes gradually as the relationship develops, as the trust in the individuals develop, and if the philosophy is presented properly that surrender is necessary, then gradually the surrender comes. So surrender is actually a desirable beginning point when things really can begin going fast in education. But it so happens that it is not the first point that occurs in the dealings between authorities and their dependents, between the teachers and the students. It is not by any means the first point. It is something that usually develops, if at all, over a long period of time. So therefore, teachers find themselves, as do all those other types of authorities that we mentioned, temple presidents, husbands, parents dealing with children, even gurus dealing with disciples. They find themselves dealing with those who are not yet surrendered, practically speaking. Even gurus with disciples, it is like that. So how to deal with those behaviors of the, how to deal with those who are not surrendered. That is the question that we're going to be addressing in the next few days. Now, there are so many behaviors that a student will engage in. Now, the first discrimination, which we've drawn out on page 123, is that a teacher has to make is between acceptable and unacceptable behavior. Again, this is true for the guru-disciple relationship, husband-wife, parents, children, temple president, etc., the whole gamut. The first discrimination is to look at behavior as either acceptable or unsatisfactory. Unsatisfactory in this terms means unacceptable. Now, what determines how a teacher views the behavior in judging it either as acceptable or unacceptable, or acceptable and unsatisfactory? We've listed some specific points. Now, sometimes due to the individuality of a teacher, and you see this all the time, what's acceptable for one teacher will be considered unsatisfactory from another teacher, by another teacher. So the individuality of the teacher is one point. A second point is time, place, and circumstance. Because what's acceptable at one time may be completely unacceptable at another time, in another place, in another circumstance. And you see this with young children. They don't understand this. They go to... they're in their house and they're running around drawing on the walls, and the parents... They take big crayons and they write A on the wall and then B, and then the parents maybe will pat them on the head and say, oh, he's learning his alphabet. How nice. And then they go to their neighbor's house and they think, wow, last time I got patted on the head for doing this. So he takes out a big, thick black crayon and he draws a big A on the wall and then a big B, and he smiles up and expects to get patted on the head, and rather, you know, they start yelling at him, because time and place and circumstance makes a great difference whether something is acceptable or not. Another point is the specific individuality of the student, because what may be acceptable and very, very good for one student may be completely unacceptable and unsatisfactory for another student. A student who is more advanced, he has to behave more properly. Sometimes in the early days of the movement, devotees had trouble with this concept. In the early days, Mukunda Maharaj knows that in San Francisco, the devotees sometimes would go, they would leave the temple and go out and smoke a cigarette every now and then in the park, and Prabhupada sometimes would go out maybe and bring them back, or sometimes they would be eating donuts, was it, at the donut shop, and Prabhupada would gently tell them not to do that. In the beginning it was just chant Hare Krishna and you can keep your long hair, and you often see pictures of Hayagriva especially with, you know, huge mountains of hair. And Prabhupada, in the beginning, didn't mind that at all. And later on, I personally heard him lecture in New Zealand, where there was a controversy about shaving up or not. And Prabhupada said that if you are my disciple, you must keep a shaved head. Otherwise, you are not my disciple. So at different times and different places and different circumstances, one thing is acceptable or not. And the individuality of the student again. Sometimes Prabhupada would be very strict with one particular devotee and he would be more lenient with another. One time Prabhupada wanted me to do something, stay in Hong Kong. I wasn't able to do it. And then I went back I was in Australia and I said, asked Prabhupada, what should I do? He said, just go where you are peaceful. So he gave me a very, very instruction, the kind of instruction I wanted to be able to follow at that time. Just take it easy, you know, because that's all I could do, and that was acceptable by him at that time, and gradually it grew again from there. So what's acceptable for one is not acceptable for another. So a teacher has to make these discriminations. But in his consciousness, when he's deciding acceptable and inacceptable, unacceptable or acceptable and unsatisfactory, he basically should be tolerant and compassionate, because he's an individual. He should not use that as an excuse to be intolerant. Well, I'm an intolerant individual and I'm not compassionate by nature. What can I do? This is my individuality. And therefore I can be very hard and harsh on the students for every little thing they do. No, because the basic principle of a teacher is he is brahminical, and he is acting for the welfare of others, not for his own welfare. So he tries to minimize, practically speaking, his own likes and dislikes, and tries to maximize his activities that are done in relationship to the students to maximize what is good for the student. And he tries to keep that his view, although definitely, without a doubt, everyone has their limitations. As individuals, we have our limitations of what we can accept and what we can't accept, and that is also taken into account. So there is a balancing that has to be done by a teacher when he decides what is acceptable and what is unacceptable. Now, the big question comes, are there any questions up to this point? Yeah.
How this concept of surrender, will not be understood as a surrender as the ability to accept? Suppose I'm going to study mathematics, and then I'm not surrendered to the teacher, but I'm accepting what he's saying. I'm not questioning his knowledge of mathematics. Is this not a kind of surrender?
It's a kind of surrender, but it's not very much of a surrender, as is appropriate for someone who's teaching mathematics, but as it is not appropriate, really, for someone who is learning spiritual life. I also make the distinction sometimes between surrender and cooperation. For the purposes of gaining the mathematics, you're cooperating with the math teacher and you're accepting his authority in a limited sphere. But when it comes to spiritual life, surrender means you take your heart and you give it to him. You agree to serve him. And this was actually the mood towards all teachers in Vedic times. In contemporary times, you even see it, how it's changed in the last 20 years, even in ISKCON, that previously respect was given for the position. Just because someone had a position, whether he's a sannyasi or a GBC man or a temple president or even a temple commander, just because he had the position, he was respected. But nowadays, it's more like that you have to prove yourself to every individual person and earn the respect from every individual person before you can get it. Well, prove to me that you're worthy of my respect. So in contemporary times, no one is willing to give respect. I mean, very begrudgingly, people respect others. But in Vedic times, and even in contemporary civilization in India, people, they don't mind giving respect. You see that they call, just someone walks along and they say, "Oh Maharaj, how are you today?" Have you seen that? Oh, they call everyone Maharaj. You know, someone who they want to give a little respect to, like that. And they don't mind so much. They're not begrudging about giving a little extra respect. But especially if one has been brought up in the West,
not only does one not like to give respect, one you have to make sure the person is completely worthy of every little bit that you're going to be begrudgingly given. So this, it doesn't breed actually the right consciousness, the transference of material knowledge or spiritual knowledge. It doesn't breed anything good actually, because you're talking about mathematics, but every teacher of anything, he will give. See, math teachers, and today they're getting paid by the hour or by the week or by the month or something like that. But he's worked very hard maybe, and he has some very, very, even a math teacher has some very interesting tricks in math that he's picked up by the grace of God. And naturally, if you see someone who's very eager and understands that he is expert in math, naturally he likes to reveal those to special people. What to speak of in Krishna consciousness? I see this even in teaching writing. I teach in every subject, practically speaking, that when someone pleases you, values your position, knows his position as dependent, then naturally you want to reveal to him the deep secrets that you keep in your heart. When we went to the university in the 60s, oh, it was so pleasurable challenging the teachers. You know, everything that they unhesitatingly accepted as knowledge, we loved to challenge them. And we loved harassing them and driving them crazy. And sitting there in the class, and like this, they'd be trying to explain some philosophy, we'd sit there. But that doesn't tempt someone to open their heart and bestow upon the student the blessings that he has in there. And don't think that people don't have blessings and secret treasures that they keep. But they will give it to qualified people. In Krishna consciousness, it's just true to an exponential degree. But everyone has these things, just like the father with his son. When the son has the right mood, the father will give him everything that he has. Everything. Even if it means that he'll have to become bankrupt. If the son is in the right mood, the father will give him everything. Everything. Because he captures his heart. So once you have the heart, what is everything else is secondary. So there are certain, these etiquettes are not superficial, but they're scientifically made as the way for the student to capture the heart of the teacher. They come in and they pay, the students pay their obeisances. The children are taught in Vedic times when they see their parents, what do? Is any bona fide Hindus from Hindu families? Anyone do that when they were children? Did you do that? It is so glorious. One friend of mine who has many disciples told me he has one disciple. Due to his training with his parents, when he sees him in the morning, he first touches his feet like that. And he said naturally his heart just melts like that. Immediately, just like obeisances, sincere obeisances, immediately. Even if you have anger towards someone, it's immediately given up. These etiquettes are not superficial. They should not be done mechanically. But they're purposeful. They're scientific.
And in the Vedic culture, say if there was a military official, and if the soldier fought all the general and fought, you know, even if he wasn't on the right side, if he died in the battle, he would go to the heavenly planet to make some advancement. And my question is, with knowledge, we hear warnings that sometimes the person, the student, has a good attitude but follows a teacher that's not teaching the right thing, that he may follow his teacher, you know, to some bad destination. So I have trouble totally understanding that, because it seems like if someone has a relatively good intention, that would be somehow computed into persuasion.
But if he's fully devoted, there's one story that Giriraj Maharaj told me And when someone asked Prabhupada, I think about disciples of Sai Baba, where will they go? So Prabhupada answered that that whoever you worship, you will go to that place. And they said, well, how about him? Well, he said, if they're really, really disciples, good disciples, you know, who really have affection and reverence and respect for their spiritual master, Sai Baba, and worship him completely, they will go where he goes. And he's going to hell. So they will also go to hell. Yeah, this is nature. This is the laws of nature. Yam yam bhavi smram bhavam tajat man dekalevaram. Because naturally they'll be thinking of him at the time of death. So one should have it's an obvious point that if you're going to learn mathematics from someone who neither can add nor subtract, you're going to end up with hell's worth of mathematics. So that is why one surrenders to a teacher, is because the education isn't mandatory. And you have teachers who are expert, and you have to approach him and ask him to be your student. Ask him to be your, please accept me as your student. So there is weight on the person who wishes to acquire knowledge. In Vedic times, though, there weren't so many bogus people either. This is Kali Yuga, the age of hypocrisy. So not only are real teachers hard to find, but sincere students are hard to find. Usually it's a good arrangement, but between the cheaters and the cheated. So education actually, if one is not surrendered, brings to the point, is meant to bring one to the point of surrender first before the real education can begin. The student must be holding on tight. Yes.
So how does that fit into the analogy of the student having a hold on the rope against the teacher?
So the real pull doesn't come until he's holding on. There's a limit to how much one can learn. Because at any time, if the person is on the mental platform, he can let go. So how much will he pull, the teacher pull? How much can he pull? He wants him to hold on. Therefore, advancement is measured in faith, and faith actually will turn into love. Therefore, I advise all of you to be very honest in dealing with your spiritual masters, and open. Because faith will not come unless you are open in heart. How will you ever, because you're keeping so many secrets inside, How will those doubts be removed?
So, is it right or is it wrong? One is doubtful for accepting the spiritual aspects. Should we inquire? And how long is
it? From?
Should we inquire?
From all respects, yes. And one shouldn't accept initiation until one is sure that he's my spiritual master, that I trust him as Krishna's working through him. Why make a travesty of the whole thing and accept a spiritual master we don't accept as a spiritual master? How silly. Better to wait and wait and wait and wait and wait and wait until we're sure. But we should know at that time when we're waiting that we should be crying and lamenting how my heart isn't pure enough and Krishna hasn't opened my heart to see who has brought me to my spiritual master like that. We should not be sitting, oh, I'm waiting. I'm not convinced yet. Not in that mood. We should be breaking our head against the blackboard if there's a blackboard handy. and lamentation and crying, how much we need this type of guidance. And yet we're so fallen that Krishna has given so many other people, led them to the lotus feet of a guru, but he's neglected us. So if we balance that wanting to be convinced with the attitude of intense desire. So I'm speaking somewhat theoretically now, you'll have to all forgive me, because in Kali Yuga everything is difficult, especially faith and surrender. But this is actually what it must come to. Faith is very hard to come by in Kali Yuga. Very hard to come by. And if Krishna awards us faith, we should guard it very carefully. Okay. Now, when we have a student, and again we're talking about those in subordinate positions, and we're in the teacher position, and everyone is at one time or another in one of the positions or another. And even the spiritual master, he's thinking himself simply disciple. But in any case, we have to act in this way. Now, how do we deal with a student's behavior that we have understood to be unacceptable? That is the next question. We judged it after considering time, place, and circumstance, etc. And my individuality and the individuality and capacity of the student, and I'm compassionate and tolerant, etc. But this person's behavior is unacceptable. How to deal with that unacceptable behavior? That will occur in two different circumstances. Either the student is surrendered, or the student is unsurrendered. And generally, if we say that there's a mixture of surrender and unsurrender, which is most of our cases, that means unsurrendered, actually. When there's no mixture, it means surrendered. If you're holding onto the rope and you're dangling, 300 feet above the ground, it's sort of like saying, well, sometimes I'm sort of holding on and sometimes I'm sort of not holding on. That means you're not holding on. So, how do you deal with unacceptable behavior in a student? Now, we are going to learn how to make a very interesting discrimination. Now, the class started at, so we still have some time left, yes? It ends at 5:10, right? Right? Okay. Now, we're going to learn how to make a discrimination which we're not taught to make. When there's a problem, the discrimination that we're going to learn to make is whose problem is it? So if someone is causing me trouble, whose problem is it? Or if he's in trouble, whose problem is it? This discrimination I'd like to discuss now, because depending upon whose problem it is, the teacher will act in one way or another in dealing with the problem. So what I would like to do is for 10 minutes, none of you have read this, unfortunately. It's from 129 to 134. What I'm going to do now is for 10 minutes explain it very simply. Then we'll break into very small groups of 3 or 4, or most 5. And I want you to go over it, reading it as quickly as you can, and seeing if you understand it or seeing what questions you have. Then we'll have a half hour lesson tomorrow on this, more, and then we'll have the test. This point is of who owns the problem, of problem ownership. I've seen it change people's lives. Because so much of the anxiety we feel, or an authority feels, is trying to solve problems that he doesn't have power to solve. and he creates simply anxiety for himself. And this can help this very much. Now we're going to define student the top problems that the teacher has and problems that the student has, and make a distinction here. A problem that the student has is a problem that doesn't tangibly and concretely, I'm going to write these two words on the board. I'm going to erase all my fancy artwork so you can imagine how important these two words are. And see how big I'm writing. Look how important they are. Did I spell it right? I didn't even get close. Tangibly. Okay?
Tangibly?
Yeah, that's correct.
And then, thank you. And concretely, we won't bother with the whole word, but you get the idea. Tangibly and concretely. If the activities of another person, the students, are tangibly and concretely disturbing the teacher, stopping him from teaching, doing his service, stopping the other students from learning, then he has a problem.
This teacher.
If his business is to teach, and if activities of others are tangibly and concretely, not abstractly or mentally so much, but actually tangibly and concretely stopping him from doing what he's supposed to do, he has the problem. It's his problem. He owns the problem. Wait, let me just do the other half. Now, if the activities of another, of a student, are not tangibly and concretely affecting the teacher's teaching, then the student has a problem. For instance, if one of the bad boys in the back row, when I'm teaching and I turn my back, when we were young, you know, maybe the students would shoot a rubber band or something like that. Nowadays, I think, they do something and they cause a disturbance, everyone starts laughing, and then the teacher, does that tangibly and concretely affect the teacher's ability to teach?
Yes.
Yeah. Well, if the whole class is jumping up and down and he's throwing things, I think it would. Tangibly and concretely, he's not imagining it or anything. So that means the teacher has a problem and he'll deal with it in one way. But on the other hand, if a student is just staring out the window, which often happens, he's just staring out the window and his mind is wandering, does that concretely or tangibly affect the teacher's teaching? No. So who has the problem?
Students.
The student's problem. Right. Now, why is this problem ownership important? Let's go a step forward at a time. Now, the teacher's job is the job of his management, his classroom management, or all his management. This is talking about temple president, husband, parents dealing with children, teachers with students, guru with disciples, is to maximize the time when there's no problems so that the actual learning and activities can be taking place. So these problems or unacceptable behavior, which are divided into two, problems and no teachers' problems and students' problems, his management's purpose is to minimize those. For instance, if I'm the teacher and if I have to write lengthy things on the board with my back turned to my 8th grade class, and I'm going to be with my back turned for 15 minutes, that's bad management. It's going to maximize the problem naturally, whatever problems that will occur. But if I'm writing like this, for instance, or if I have it on flip charts, already prepared in advance. That's good management. It's going to minimize the problems that are going to occur. So the job of management is to maximize the amount of time that is no problem. Now, when these problems occur, problems meaning there's unacceptable behavior, the teacher first tries to understand whose problem is it. If it's his problem, if it tangibly and concretely affects his teaching, it's stopping him from teaching, tangibly and concretely, he deals with that problem in one particular way. He can lay down the law. You cannot do this in this classroom. You are not allowed to do this in this classroom. There is no one who is allowed to throw chalk at the other students or hit other students in this classroom, possibly because it's interfering concretely. He can lay down the law, and if you don't like it, you go and see the principal or you go outside. He lays down the law, basically. He can invoke law. But what happens if it's something that's the student's problem and he tries to lay down the law? A good example that teachers who are leading the Gurukula students in japa often come up against is that you want them to chant japa, naturally, because the holy names are so wonderful. So one child is just So teachers often, so whose problem is that if the student is just going? Right, it's definitely the student's problem, right? Because it's not concretely affecting the teacher. So one problem is when the teacher treats that problem as if it's his own problem. And he tries to lay down the law. And what happens is, okay, start chanting now. Just like I could say to you, stop hitting him now. Start chanting now. Now what happens when I say to you, stop hitting him now? If you don't do what I say, I can force you to obey me. But what happens when the case is your problem? You're not chanting. Okay, if you don't start chanting now, I'm going to beat you. I'm going to what? There's nothing a teacher can do to start a student chanting if the student has decided I'm not going to chant. He can't force him to chant because he will run out of power. And teachers often go at confrontations like that when it's not their problem, as if it was their problem, as if they had the power to force someone to do something that they don't want to do. And ultimately, they are bluffing and they will run out of power. And this is the basic explanation, although I'm sure it's not clear in everyone's mind at this point. This is the basic explanation why teachers make this distinction between what's my problem and what's the problem of others. Because when someone else has a problem, you can't force them to change their ways. There are many other ways you can deal with them, but you cannot force them. And when people, the teachers or the authorities, try to force others to do things that ultimately they cannot force them to do, big, big, big problems occur. Okay, now rather than explaining more or taking many questions at this point, what I would like to do is break you up into groups. And I want you to go through the same information up to page 135 and study it a little more. 134 rather. And talk about it in the small groups, discuss it, try to understand it, and then we'll discuss it further tomorrow. Because the reason why I'd like to do it like this is that you have the test tomorrow, and it may not be time for you to study much for this lesson, and it's so important. so many problems that temple presidents have, husbands have, parents have, teachers have, even gurus have in dealing with their disciples, is based on not understanding where their power begins and where their power actually ends. Again, if someone is completely surrendered, then there is no problem. If they're surrendered as they should be, all you have to do is say, start chanting, and then the child starts chanting. But usually they're not surrendered. So therefore, it has to be dealt with in a different way. Okay, without discussing this more, why don't you break into groups of three. That's a nice number, actually.